Thank you. So the first thing to do is make sure that this works, right? And you confirm for me that it works. Okay, good. Well, thank you for having me. I thought maybe I'd say a few things about myself so that you can understand maybe why microdevelopment is such an interesting topic for me. I spent a lot of years teaching high school science and a few years teaching middle school science and a number of years teaching science at the undergraduate level as well. So if I total that all up, that comes to about 20-something years. And I noticed in the very beginning of my career that I was learning the science much better than my students. And I didn't understand why that was, because every year I certainly learned more about what I was doing, not just as a teacher, but also about the content that I was presenting. It made more and more sense to me every year, and I thought my presentations were changing enough so that students would definitely benefit from that as well. But unfortunately, I found out that that just wasn't the case. I think it was actually quite by accident. I was saving a lot of exams over the years. These were the Scantron kinds of tests that you use for filling the bubbles. So I was just saving them year after year. And again, I think I was saving them not because I intended to do anything with them, but it was because the desk was closer than the garbage. So every year we go into the same file cabinet, and about 5 years later what I did was I looked at all of those Scantron tests and I said, well, I've certainly become a much better teacher. I certainly know a lot more than I did when I started. The same should be true for my students. So I took all the Scantron tests, 5 years worth, and the nice thing about Scantron, you just put it through the machine, tells you what the average was, and it didn't take very much statistics to see that over 5 years, the average hadn't changed more than a point. This was disastrous to my own thoughts about my ability to become a better teacher. I couldn't explain it away. I looked at that data for, I guess a good part of a year, trying to think, how could I explain I'd gotten better, but my students hadn't gotten any better? Well, that's really the context that brings me to today. It's been a long voyage. I think I've probably spent the remaining 15 years trying to figure out why it is that it was so hard for them to get any better. So what I'd like to do today is take you through a partial part of that journey by doing several things. First, starting with your thoughts about microdevelopment. Now, I'm not looking for anything profound, and I'll give you a chance to think about that for a few seconds. I'll kind of go through the plan, and then I'll come back to that first point. What have you gained so far from the readings or your thoughts, or even looking at the word micro and development and sticking the two together, like we do in English a lot, kind of put two words together, all of a sudden we have a new word. What does that mean to you? I'd like to do something beyond that. I'd like to build on that understanding by capturing microdevelopment in process in this class. So there'll be a period during the class where you'll have a chance to interact with each other, interact with me and the TS and anyone else who wants to become part of that interaction. And we'll collect some data on that experience and we'll see if we can analyze it and make sense of it from a microdevelopmental point of view. To make sense of anything in life, well, actually from an academic point of view, I suppose, you need to use some kind of framework. And in sciences, we tend to think about those frameworks as models. And the word model itself might bring lots of things to mind. And I typically ask people what comes to mind when I use the word model. And I get a variety of examples, like someone walking down the stage wearing very nice clothes, or something that you hang from the ceiling, like an airplane model. But here I'm going to be thinking about a model in terms of how is it that you organize the things that you see and that you think about to make sense of a phenomenon. Now, I take for granted that you've been working a lot with the model of skill theory in this class, so that's a model that I'm going to be using and that you'll be using as well. So that'll be the fourth thing that we'll do. Then I'd like to spend a little bit of time with the article that Kurt and I wrote, Building versus Borrowing. And again, I'm going to start with your reactions to the article, and I'm going to try and take your reactions and dovetail those into our experiences. So we'll sort of see how that evolves. So it'll sort of be a dynamic experience. You'll notice that the word "your" shows up a lot, because I definitely believe now, as opposed to any other time in my career, that what I say and what I do up front makes absolutely no difference to your education. I mean, for a while it might be entertaining, but in the long run, your own education is something that you build. So I'm going to try and emphasize that by going back to you throughout this entire, I think it's hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever we have, and soliciting your remarks, your thoughts, and your reactions. So that will mean that I will wait a long time to get it. So I'm not sure how long the wait time will have to be. But I just want to prepare you for that. The very last thing we'll do is we'll summarize. And I'd like to maybe make a few parting comments about what this means to me as an educator. So I am a little interested how many of you see yourselves as educators in this class. Okay, good. So I'll be talking to a good part of you. For the rest of you who didn't put up your arms or hands, I will suggest that in your lives you'll have plenty of opportunities, either as a parent or maybe working with the staff or the people, to think about how do you bring both either your child or the people that you work with up to a different way of thinking about whatever it is that is of interest to you or the child. So let's just start with that first thing. What does it mean to you, microdevelopment? And again, notice when I ask you, what does it mean to you? I'm not looking for an answer that I have. I'm interested in what the answer is, or what it is that these two words, or this one word together, means to you right now, at the start of this class. Ah, the first brave soul. Thank you. That's the hardest hand to raise.
Microdevelopment to me means development or changes that take place over the very short term, and how I would say from a scholarly sense, looking at development and the very small pieces and small changes that take place that I presume aggregate up to big changes.
Okay, thank you. I see an accident in the making. Do we need turn signals?
I don't know if this is actually accurate.
But it's your reaction.
You were asking for our own sense of it. To me, I see both vertical and horizontal properties to development. And I have a hard time, the way that microdevelopment is used in the studies is, you know, over these short time periods. But I have a hard time saying, you know, it's this little period of time. To me, it makes more sense to think of microdevelopment as being the development of one particular skill over the course of development, and macrodevelopment as what do all these skills look like over time? You know, where you can see the patterns and the discontinuities.
Thank you. So.
I mean, the word microdevelopment could be, if we're talking about a process, not human development, right?
Not human?
You can use the word even if you're talking about any process, not particularly development of a person. In that sense, it would mean for me the tiny steps, the details that you take to make up the whole. So it's just the finer grain details. That's what microdevelopment means to me.
Okay. Does someone have a very different view of microdevelopment? Okay. We have a somewhat different view. Is that what that meant?
I don't necessarily have a different view, but I have a sort of, I just wanted to maybe add to that inherent in looking at something through the lens of microdevelopment, there's somewhat of an assumption or a framework that you believe that as you go down in scalar pieces of time or within dividing domains into smaller domains, you're just making a leap of faith in a sense, or based on data, not a leap of faith, that you can look at something on that scale and that it will tell us something about the big picture as well. That you're not just looking at it for the sake of the aesthetic beauty of small steps with it. It's providing information that on the larger scale will be informative. And so that you need to have that, I guess, if you're trying to answer the big questions, you need to have that, I guess, assumption or belief that it's meaningful.
So you have some doubts about whether or not what we see in the short term has anything to say about what happens over the long term.
It's not necessarily that I have doubts. It's that you need to have those doubts, I guess. So that needs to be a question that's asked, not assumed.
Okay, I think that's an important point to make, that you're calling to attention the assumptions that we're holding. And in any kind of model that we use to explain anything that we try to make sense of, certainly it's important to recognize the assumptions that we're holding. All right, thank you. Is anybody thinking about, at this point, the words learning and microdevelopment as being words that inform each other or have nothing to do with each other? Any thoughts about that?
I tend to think of learning sometimes is referred to more as an end product, and microdevelopment is often more of a process.
Okay, thank you. So we have end product, finished product versus what took us there, the process that got us there. Yes.
I think totally different. I see learning as as a process of development, so I think it's really related to microdevelopment.
Okay, thank you.
And it seems like if you were to look through the lens of microdevelopment at one student from, say, an educator's point of view, you could find a lot about how that student learns and what different factors go into the learning and would affect the microdevelopment.
Okay. So the educator would, in this case, if I'm not putting words in your mouth, place less importance on the end product, but take advantage of the process to see how they might intervene to shape the direction that the process takes. Okay? Yes, Michelle.
I would also add to that to say that learning often refers to learning content knowledge as well as learning skills, where microdevelopment is less involved with, you know, learning this particular fact, but is more related to learning skills that may help you to learn different facts, but are a separate thing.
So that's an interesting distinction. So there's, on the one hand, there are these facts, sort of body of facts, and then there's this process that takes us to those facts or may incorporate those facts. Okay, we'll get a chance to play with that. All right, one last one.
I was thinking along the same lines as Michelle, but I was thinking if you're going to address what you were talking about earlier with your students and their growth and depth of understanding, it would also have to take them into developing actual concepts. I agree with what everyone else has said about skills and you know, the smaller parts of development, but it would eventually have to lead to some kind of conceptualization of deep understanding.
Uh-huh. So here's a question I didn't prepare, but sort of was provoked by the last couple of comments. Is learning a fact a skill in the sense of skill theory? I see some no's. Okay. Yeah, sure, we'll get one comment. I just wanted a reaction to that.
I think having the ability to apply the fact is a skill. Like, you know, I used to teach English as a second language for years, so knowing that a noun is a person, place, and thing, I don't think that's a skill, but understanding how to use it in a sentence is.
Okay. Know. All right, thank you. So I'm going to sort of give you an opportunity to sort of challenge those views that you have. One thing that I won't make explicit, so I'll just tell you about it, I think in general, in all the courses that I teach, it's important to start off with what your views are on any topic, so that at the end of the experience you can at least say, I either changed my mind or I still have the same view. It's a little bit of a different experience where if you go through a lecture or you go through any kind of experience and at the end you're not quite sure whether or not your views have changed or how they've changed or why they've changed. So we'll sort of hold out these views right now as some of the starting points for this presentation. So what I'd like to do now is get us involved with actually capturing the phenomenon of microdevelopment. So that's not a static term for us. And I'm going to do this all with your help. So what's nice about this activity is that to the extent that you become involved with it, we will get a lot of rich data that we can work with. There are several things that I will need for you to sort of bear in mind in terms of microdevelopment. There's the contextual part of this experience, so we're going to spend some time thinking about the impact of the environment. I would imagine that I'll speak for myself. I'll see, maybe you have similar views. When I originally started thinking about the environment as a biologist or a biochemist when I first started my career, the environment was always something that was outside of me but had very little impact on me personally. Like, so I studied trees or the effects of hydrocarbons on plants, but it was always something that went on outside of me. And I'm going to encourage you today to think about the environment as, well, we don't have trees in the room, but we have each other, and that each of us can impact each of the people in the room, including ourselves, so that this environment is something that it's a dynamic opportunity to affect not just someone outside of you, someone around you, but someone can affect you in turn. And that's an idea that we'll build on later as well. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we'll try to do is we'll try to use skill theory to model the actual data that we collect. I won't take it all the way to the end. And the reason I won't take it all the way to the end is because I'd like to leave you with a challenge. So I'm going to let you know up front that the problem that I'm going to give you, I won't resolve for you. But I'll resolve a similar problem, and we'll talk about how they might help you learn how to solve the problem I'm about to show you and the one that we'll tackle later. This is a challenge we'll tackle. This is a conceptual problem. Now, some of you may know this problem, and that's good, actually, from my point of view. And some of you may not know this problem, and that's also good from my point of view. The challenge will be separating those who know from those who don't know initially, and eventually bringing them together so they can work with each other. Now, I'm going to sort of spell out the challenge. Here's the first step in the challenge. And we're going to work in small little teams to figure out who is going to be a problem solver and who is going to watch and who is going to be a supporter. But I'll spell these things out all in time. I'm just letting you know that this challenge may evoke an answer, and you might want to shout out that answer, but restrain yourselves. All right, so Farmer Jones needs to cross a river to transport a chicken, a fox, and a bag of grain to the market. And at the river, there's a canoe just large enough for Farmer Jones and one of the three items he's bringing to market. He must be careful. I guess I could read it from here. He must be careful because leaving the chicken with the fox or the chicken with the grain will have disastrous results. I'm so used to working with small children like my own. Sometimes I worry about, did that make sense? Okay, good. Thank you. So I can see my daughter saying, "But what's disastrous?" All right, here's your challenge. What strategy should Farmer Jones use to get all three across the river without one consuming the other? So two things are at risk of being consumed, and only one thing can be brought across at a time. Here's how we'll collect your answers. There'll be a problem solver, and this person doesn't know the answer to that challenge. Is there anybody in the room who is in that situation? Doesn't know the answer.
Forgot the answer, too.
Forgot the answer is fine, too. Okay, good. Oh, that's a good number of you. Okay. So I'm going to be using you in an instant. Now, the role of the supporter, somebody already knows the answer. How many of you already know the answer? Okay, I'm going to ask you to raise your hands in a few more minutes. because what we're going to do is we're going to match up supporters with problem solvers. And we'll do. It looked like there was quite a few more problem solvers and supporters, but we'll figure that out in just a second. And there'll be one last person who will be collecting the data. And to collect the data, what I'd like you to do is you can use something roughly that looks like that. It doesn't have to be like that. The key thing is, during the 5 to 10 minutes that we play with this activity, what I'd like the observer to do is to watch what the person does, watch what the person says. The time part, that is only to give you some sense of chronologically how these events unfold. It's not absolutely important, but it might be useful when I ask you later to tell us the story of what happened. There's a section here for drawing because maybe it's easier to draw what happened instead of actually say what happened. So to kind of give you an idea, first thing that the problem solver did was either said, I'm going to take the fox across the river, or they might have taken a piece of paper and drawn a little canoe and put the fox and the farmer in the canoe. And so there's lots of ways in which this information can be transmitted. And this is just a way of giving you an idea of how you might capture that. I'd like you to also keep track of other, it may seem unimportant information. And this is more of sort of the affective reaction to the problem. So the problem solver is banging the pencil on the table. So keep track of everything that's taking place, both towards the end product, which is how does the person get the three items across the river, and also what kinds of intermediate or what kinds of other experiences are taking place at the same time. All right, so now that was the easy part from my point of view. I sort of laid out the challenge. The somewhat more difficult part will be matching you up. So the people who know the answers, can I see you again? There's up high, so I can 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Now, keep those hands up. Everybody else, take a look at those individuals. They know the answer. Right? But, oh, they think they do. Now, what I want you to do, you can put your arms down for a second. I'm going to ask you to put them up in just a second again, so that when we actually move, you'll be able to go to those individuals. Problem solvers, you're not entitled to tell the answer. Now, that's hard to do. As a supporter, you can ask the problem solver what they're doing, why they're doing it. But I want you to resist laying out the path to the right answer. Because this is not about you. This is about the problem solver and trying to uncover the process that they take to getting to the answer. Now, this is very difficult. And the observer, you might need to occasionally remind the supporter of what their role is. Because I think as teaching as an enterprise has convinced us that if we know the answer, then our task is to give the answer. So we'll try and break that that strategy. Yes. No, you're focusing on the problem solver and what the problem solver is doing. And only to the extent that that you're focusing on the supporter if he or she needs some reminders about the direction in which they're giving that support. If it seems like they're being a lot too much like, here's how the steps would unfold. You want to resist that. All right, now you're going to have to break up into some groups of, they may be, the minimum would be three. Okay. Problem solver, an observer, and a supporter. But there may be more, right? So depending on how things break out. So I think since the smallest number we have of individuals is the supporters, then they'll put up their hands and you'll start forming groups around them. And once you have a group formed, I'd like you to all sort of look at me, and that'll be a cue that we can start, because I only want to give this about 5-6 minutes. All right, so from the supporters, keep the hands up. And the supporters, you might have to move away from with Farmer Jones and his ensemble. Any group not come up with a solution? Ah, one group is still working. Okay. Well, we'll provide a solution in just an instant so that you can go home feeling like you learned something today. What I want to do first is, though, I want to collect some ideas, or actually some of the data that the observers collected for us. Just a few of you, if you would. Tell us a little bit about what you noticed happening. And for the rest of us, let's sort of listen to what happened in that story that may have allowed the solution to become obvious or unfold. Some of you talked about the solution appearing. I've talked to a few of you. But in talking with you a little bit about that moment of appearing, you realized that there were some steps that facilitated that. As some of you said, aha. So let's see if we can get to that for a few minutes. Our observers.
Well, Laura started very excited and was really wound up and started drawing and moving with her hands and talking out loud. So she was definitely speaking through the process with lots of what ifs and what if I do this and what if I do this. And then the encourager, your supporter, right? Supporter, after about a minute of Laura's hurriedness, said, you know, there's no time limit for this. You can take as many trips as you want. And then Laura kind of sat for a second and said, oh, and then immediately verbalized Andrew and acted out kind of the solution to the problem.
So as many trips as she could.
I just said that there's no time limit.
There's no time limit. And that helped you. Okay, thank you. Another observer. Whatever happened.
We had somewhat of a larger group, and so three individuals working on it, and they talked to each other through the whole process, but each one was writing individually in their notebooks, and when we compared their pages afterward, everyone had arrows going back and forth. So even though they were doing their own thing, it pretty much was the same process for each, but some people drew pictures and others did it more numerically.
Numerically?
Yeah, like just very systematic arrows.
As steps?
Going, yeah.
Step one, bring chicken across, or
right.
Step two, okay. All right, thank you. Okay.
I want to bring up two quick things. The first thing I noticed that when we started, our problem solver had already been thinking about it, and so there was a certain amount of thinking that we couldn't really observe or track, which I think probably started when she saw the problem 10 minutes before we began. So that was the first thing. The other thing I wanted to talk about quickly was that our supporter had created or cut out pieces of paper and wrote the names of the things on it, and then to let the problem solver play around with it. And I think that was kind of a good way to help visualize without giving too overt a clue.
Okay, that's it. So far, there are three different ways in which people try to solve the problem. They used arrows, so one symbolic way of showing or representing what's happening over time. People cut out paper and another symbol, numbers, numerically, to indicate what's happening over time. So far, three different strategies.
Yeah, so we had two problem solvers, so it was really interesting to see how one person was really verbal from the beginning. Right? She was actually talking about all these possibilities outside the problem, like kind of pushing the canoe or just kind of like going to all these sort of mechanisms. And then the other problem solver was actually more quiet, kind of like assigning variables to like each individual and kind of like solving it in a more abstract way. And then
the supporter was actually attentive to all the process, like everything that was going on, and actually spoke after maybe 5 minutes of like the problem solvers actually just throwing out ideas. So he was very verbal in the beginning for one part, and then the person that was actually thinking more abstract was actually saying, oh, so I can relate this problem to other types of problems where maybe the person can actually take some animal back. Then that sparkled, like, the other person's verbal reaction, like, oh, so, and started just talking about all these other possibilities. And then at the end, actually previous knowledge just prompted the solution. Previous knowledge of, like, that fact that's assigning, like, kind of, like, matching up this experience to another experience, and also talking about the chicken being problematic. And then that actually just, the actual solving of the problem took, like, less than 2 minutes.
Yes. I had the opportunity to talk with that group, which was nice. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to talk with all of you. I can't see your name from here. Margie? Yeah, Margie likened this to a child, that if you have a child that you cannot leave unsupervised, then you always keep the child with you. And the key for that group was that once they realized that the chicken was represented the same problem, got to keep the chicken with you. Okay, I'd like to move on and get the problem solvers a chance to talk a little bit about their experience. And it doesn't have to be limited to just the actual process of getting to the solution, but maybe even some of your feelings and thoughts as you were working towards that end.
Well, in the beginning, I was sort of doing what she was describing. I kept bringing in outside factors. I wanted to buy ropes and hire people, and like, I wanted other things.
You wanted another problem.
Yeah.
You didn't like the one I gave you.
But when my supporter sort of finally laid out that the problem could be solved within what I was given, that I didn't need anything extraneous, that really focused me on dealing with just the criteria that were listed there. And then I was very stuck on the same chicken idea of what to do with that chicken. And she said something along the lines of, when I was coming back on one trip, she said, who's in the boat when you're coming back? I was like, the farmer. And then it dawned on me, oh, the farmer and somebody else. So that was really the aha moment, was who else is in the boat? Okay. She didn't even say who else. She just said, who's in the boat?
Okay, thank you.
So I think when I first saw the problem on the board, I really had no clue how to solve it or anything. But once we drew it, it became much, much clearer to me. Like as I talked it out, I was able to solve the problem rather than just intellectually thinking about it. I think it was more of like a verbal, like intuitive type of.
Okay. Solving. And do you mind if I share our interaction? And your name is?
Ellie.
So Ellie and I had a very provocative conversation for a few minutes. She showed me her solution, and then she asked me if she was right. And I asked her, well, does your solution work? And as far as we could tell, it worked. So I asked her, what would I do, or how might I impact by saying either you're wrong or you're right, your sense of your own solution? And we started talking a few minutes about the power that the authority might have in convincing you that your own process didn't take you necessarily to a correct answer, even though it may have been one that worked. And I asked her if I said you were wrong, would that change your sense about your answer? And she said, just maybe a little bit. So she continued working on it, and I left at that point. I don't know what happened after that. Can you tell me what happened after I left? And I said, I'll leave you with that little bit of anxiety.
So I talked to that again and decided that I was right.
And we don't need him. We can do this without him. Okay, great. Thank you. One last one.
In answering how did I as a problem solver feel about progress towards the solution, it was definitely helpful working with a supporter, because there were a couple moments where I felt a stalemate and wanted to start over and thought that the solution I was working towards wasn't going to work. And that was a frustrating experience and confusing. But then as we used several different visual tools and organizational tools, and there was a breakthrough that we both realized it came with drawing arrows and other things that people have talked about. You saw the light at the end of the tunnel. It was pretty exciting. All of a sudden, we realized it was going to work, and we felt good about it. And so we're patting ourselves on the back for figuring out how to get all three to market.
Thank you. I have a question for you, though. When you recognized you were frustrated, how easy was the problem solving for you at that moment?
Much more difficult.
Much more
because
difficult.
Also it took it back up almost to the abstract realm, and it was like starting from scratch with all the possible solutions as opposed to following through with it. Once a path that we'd gone down seemed not to work, it darkened the entire situation and made it a lot harder. But once, like I say, sort of the light broke through, you know, we nearly jumped up for joy. It was pretty exciting.
Okay. That's great. I want to include the supporters' voices in this.
I've been really intrigued since I've been thinking about what we went through to get to our final answer. I had done this problem before, and it took me a second to remember the trick. But then once I got it, I was like, oh, yeah, of course. But then when I was helping Stacy, it was my job to really facilitate and not to tell her the answer. So I was trying to find ways to get her to the trick. And I think it's really interesting that my job was really to unpack her assumptions, not to lead her in a direction, but just to have her spell out for me what her assumptions were. And as soon as she spelled out her assumptions, I asked two simple questions. I asked her to describe for me step by step what was happening, and then I asked her to be more specific and tell me who was in the canoe at all times. And it just made all the sense in the world. And I was very frustrated because I wanted to help her, and I saw her kind of getting worked up, and I was like, okay. And I wonder if it's not something in the teacher-student relationship or the mentor-to-protege relationship where it's not wanting to see that person fail, where we step in too soon, or we don't allow them to sort of build their own information.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that comment, because that's really the struggle of the first, my first 5 years of teaching, and certainly went into the next 5 years as well, as I tried to figure out what to do about that. But I think it's very nice the way that you are able to shift gears and just listen, and that the listening provide an opportunity for the problem solver to take into account what is it that I'm paying attention to and what is it that I'm working with. And to some extent relieve you of the burden of saying, oh, I have the answer, if I give it to you, that'll just end this nightmare or something short of a nightmare or the anxiety that I'm experiencing. And that, sort of, I guess, is a footnote. So much of our education is about ending that frustration of not knowing so that we can get on to something else we don't know so we can fill that gap as well. Yes?
So I'm not trying to be really critical of that supporting, but I do have a question about it, which is that you said that just by having the problem solver unpack their assumptions, that was a support that wasn't giving them the answer. And I guess I felt like you directed the assumptions that you were unpacking very carefully. And it seemed to me like that was actually guiding directly towards a solution. So I guess it's sort of a question of, like, I think with the support, I was lucky because my problem solver actually just worked through the whole thing, and I sort of said, oh, good. and so I didn't get stuck in that anxiety moment. But it was just more a question of, like, I think it's important for us to realize that the assumptions that we might have led people to unpack were very particular assumptions, that we didn't ask them, well, what color is the sky while you're doing this problem? We didn't ask, like, well, how big is the boat? You know, it was assumptions that were very relevant to the actual solution that you had in mind.
I appreciate that comment as well, because it's important to recognize that you aren't just talking about the color of the sky, and that what's intention, or what I see intention, is sort of the pure sort of interview where I'm just listening carefully, and to the extent that I'm listening helps the other person discover what it is that's a problem, versus I'm listening but I'm also suggesting, and as I do that, it looks a little bit more like the traditional teacher saying, all right, I've already experienced much of this. As you're about to experience it, let me just sort of direct your attention to one point of this, one part of this problem. So I guess my only point or my only comment would be that it's not a clear either or. You could exist in an either or world, but I think that the teaching moment is sort of in tension with, am I listening? Do I really understand? How can I constrain the possibility so that we're not going to pay attention to the color of the sky right now? Because maybe that is what's compelling at that instant to the person. I wonder if it's going to rain. Because if it rains, we don't have a cover for the canoe. And if we don't have a cover for the canoe, the grain will get wet. And then you're onto another problem. Yes?
I think the biggest constraint that I faced as a supporter was the decision to give unsolicited advice or not. Because the instructions were ambiguous, so I didn't know if I was supposed to wait until a question was asked of me or if I was supposed to jump in. So, it kind of speaks to the point that was made earlier about wait time. And because I think given enough time, anyone will get this. If it takes hours or days, they'll finally get it. But it's just kind of a catalyst.
Well, those are some neat assumptions to test. Anyone would get it in days or, I don't know if that's true or not, but interesting assumption. Okay, I'm glad that I have hands going up now. That feels a lot better than earlier when there was just one brave soul. What's your name again?
James
the Brave. were any solutions instantaneous by anybody who was a problem solver? I mean, anybody can answer this. Yes?
That, and then what do you do now? And then all of a sudden it clicked and the solution was there, right there.
Okay, all right. I see how you're using the word instantaneous. That moment where the answer appears to you, that's instantaneous. But what you're also saying is that it took time to get to that point. That point where it's like, oh, I got it. Yes.
As the observer watching her, it seemed like the critical point that I saw where she got the answer was realizing that it was right, that even though, you know, that basically bringing the chicken over was okay to do. She had to realize
bringing
it over first was correct, that there was no other way to start.
Okay.
And as soon as she got that and she stopped hesitating about that, it all just came instantaneously.
I see. So there was a moment there where, you probably have the time. Some 5, 10, 15 seconds where taking that first step of taking the chicken across was one that she was belaboring a little bit. Okay. Yes?
I guess I would say that the solutions couldn't be instantaneous, but I'm looking at it like if you could turn your brain off and then all of a sudden you saw the problem and then you turned your brain back on and it came to you then maybe that would be, well, no, it wouldn't even be instantaneous, but I think that because we all have prior knowledge and we all were using either reading, written word, or things on paper, that we're creating some kind of scaffolding for ourselves or from other people. So nothing was just instantaneous.
Okay.
There was background to every thought we had.
So I want to just sort of throw out a statement, and you can say whether or not it bears itself out with the evidence. All the problem solvers who attempted this problem used either some paper or some device and took some amount of time in thinking about what had to go across, what had to come back, and that evolved over many seconds, maybe something less than 10 minutes, but certainly more than 2 or 3 seconds. Anyone want to say that is not the case?
Interesting story. I think it speaks to this because we had two problem solvers, and they worked out the solution not instantaneously, but pretty easily without using any devices the first time. But then the supporter challenged them to see if they could come up with another way to solve it within the same constraints. And that was really what was interesting because I could just see like the growth curve. They just both they regressed for a second. They couldn't even remember. Well, what was the first thing we did in the first place? Oh, okay, so now they get the paper out, they start drawing the diagrams. One learner was kind of directing more of the process. The other one's kind of not as involved, but the first learner kind of turns the paper and gets the second person involved. So and I guess it just really illustrated to me that the process is a lot different when it's a task that's I guess, too easy versus something that is more challenging for them.
Okay. I'm going to summarize some of the things I've heard today, and then we'll see what we can do with that in part. So there were, and these are just sort of things that come to mind from what I've heard. There were individuals who attacked the problem by creating little symbols, chicken, fox, and grain, and physically probably, I'm making up this part, probably had something that represented the river and then thought about how to move those back and forth. There were individuals who looked at the problem and hesitated, like, no, I have this choice to make. I could make any choice, but maybe I should think about which choice I would be the right choice. I heard people talk about using arrows. I saw people using steps, where on one side of the page there was some symbol for the fox, the chicken, or the grain, and on the other side of the page there was another symbol, sort of showing where they were at each step, sort of point out when the problem would appear. That would be the chicken was left with the grain, or the fox was left with the chicken. That these steps evolved over time. Some of you found that on the way to that solution, there were moments that grew quite dark, where you couldn't see what the possible answer might be, and that became frustrating, and it seemed as though maybe you weren't going to come up with an answer. And that when the answer finally did evolve, that it seemed to be centered around some key particular part of this problem. And in this case, we got to keep the chicken under wraps. So how do we model that? So here comes the theoretical part. Now, when I use the word building a model to analyze our findings, I think one of the things that occurred to me is that this is an interesting and different way of using the word building, because this should look familiar to you. So I take that the smiles that I see out there means that yes, and that your instructors haven't failed you. Well, there's still room to go, room for improvement, or not. I am building the models right now, and I know that you didn't get a chance to read the article. I guess I just found out that you didn't get a chance to read the article, Building versus Borrowing. So this might be sort of a prelude to those of you who get a chance to read it later. As I build it, I'm sort of demonstrating my own understanding of this, which will be a lot different experience for you. You're going to be borrowing right now. That means you'll listen. Some of this might make sense. Some of it might not. You'll take some notes down during the process. And at the end, I'll feel convinced that I really understand this. And at the end, you may feel like I might have gotten parts of that. I might not have. So I'm going to be building. Later, you'll get a chance to build. But right now, I'm going to do this, sort of lay this out. So this should look familiar. This is Piaget's start at it. And the highlights of this, anybody want to recap the highlights for me? Or? I'll let you off the hook on this one. This is the important part. The sense of time. That Piaget's ideas grew over watching his children over many years, and that he noticed these changes taking place over many years. And we're going to talk about changes that take place over a much smaller period of time. But this by itself isn't enough to really help us think about what happened. So we're going to build on this. And we're seeing this again. Only this time when we see it, we're seeing it times four. When we saw it in Piaget's original, well, as the way I represented it earlier, we just saw one sort of stage. And this appears differently than the pre-operational operational. And this appears slightly different than the abstract thinking as we saw it in the earlier slide. Formal operation as Piaget characterized it. And I don't know if you talk at all about, so there's something that seems to happen prior to the sensory motor. So far in this diagram, what stands out to you is different from the first one? The one where, yes? Okay, the stages are overlapping. I'll say that again for the video. Where's the video? Which way should I address the video? I forgot what the point was. It was overlapping, that's right. I could even distract myself. Anything else that stands out? Yes. There are subdivisions. So I'll repeat back, that'll save you from running up and down the aisles. There's subdivisions. Anything else? Okay. What we're going to talk about is this movement over time. So far what we've talked about is that as Piaget, he notices these changes taking place over many years. And so far I haven't really said anything different. All I've added is some more layers to that evolution over time. And something I know that you've talked about in this course is that this evolution over time can occur over many pathways. So this is certainly the work collectively of both Howard and Kurt, so that we can maybe characterize each of these pathways as areas in which someone has built up ideas in science, or we could talk about math, or we could talk about art or music. These are all areas symbolically that I can show that this progression over time can occur in any of those domains. They could overlap, they may not overlap, they may sort of extend on their own, and right now all I've showed is that on this, so this, let's just call this some kind of a science pathway. This is the one that I'm paying attention to at the moment. And for the purposes of this class, we're going to pay attention to just one of those pathways. Maybe not the whole pathway, because the whole pathway sort of suggests that reflexes are involved here, but we don't talk much about that since that's really the world of the infant. And we may not need to use these high-powered abstractions either to think about this chicken and the fox problem. So the macro look is still something that is an idea that takes place over years. And what we want to talk about is a micro look, something that's going to take place over seconds, minutes, or hours. But as you've noticed, or maybe I'll just call your attention to it, nothing else has changed in the diagram so far. Well, some things have, I guess. Shorten the words there to some symbols. I'd like to just take a second also. This is my own representation. This looks a little bit different than representations that you've maybe seen in other readings, sort of maybe to clarify anything. Does anybody want to say anything about the differences between what I've done and what you've seen in other pictures that come through other readings? Something that stands out as confusing to you or different? Yes. Here comes the microphone. Prepare yourself.
Well, the main difference is, if I'm remembering this correctly, I was thinking that the other way I've seen it is reversed, where the skills grow.
Yes.
But is it?
Yes.
Am I remembering that right? Or?
Yes, I think there is a reading. I can remember a reading where the tree is reversed.
Okay.
Right,
but so anyway, I wanted to ask a question. I don't know if you can address it later or whatever, but I'm still not sure. First of all, when you say something like science, my understanding is that science is not really a skill, that there's all sorts of sub-skills, like something like the ability to deal with variables properly. Like, that would be a skill.
I think that's...
So I'm wondering if you could address domain issues.
I will, because that's important, because that would be confusing. That we're not going to treat this as the whole domain. We're going to treat this as something in science, an idea in science.
Okay.
Not the whole domain of science.
And then the other thing that I'm not sure is clear for other people, too, if you could just review it, is the different, the branching that happens. What does that mean? Does that mean that there's a change in development? Like, does directionality affect it? Does the length of the segment affect it? We haven't really covered that.
Okay.
In class. We've had a reading, but we haven't talked about it.
Okay. I'll see if I can address those as we kind of go through that. Here comes the microphone.
So I have two questions on the web that's drawn, or the tree. One is that I don't remember there actually being what I would call nodes before. And I don't know what you're representing with those.
Okay.
And then the other one is that you have at least one branch is kind of spanning that third stage with no stops or branches or anything. And I didn't know if that's supposed to imply that somehow there's a jump, or is it a smooth transition? This looks different than what Kurt has shown us before. So.
Yeah, and these are important questions, because as a representation, you can see that the changes might lead you to different conclusions about what I'm saying. So let me just quickly say that this is just a limitation of time, and that I didn't show all the nodes along the way. So I'm just showing some progress. But I will want to show progress over time by showing all the nodes. That's what we'll do now. So I'll take a look at that. The way we'll do this, though, is take a look at these nodes. So we'll kind of move down that path. We'll take a look at this world of single representations. And what I'd like to do now is challenge the comment earlier about is a fact a skill? We don't really get a chance to think about that very often, because it just seems like we have these facts and that we get them. And then we work with them. And then when we work with them, now we're doing some skill development. So this is a little short activity, and we'll do this just for a few minutes. So I'm watching the time to make sure that we have a chance to not only do the activity, but process it. What I'd like us to do I don't have enough for everybody, so I'm going to just give this to Ellen. And who else can help me pass these out? Now, don't open these. I know that's the first temptation. just give them out randomly. Make sure that they're spread out so that people can... If you don't have one, you're watching. You're watching. You've already done this. I think you've done this. Yes, you have done this. So you get to watch. You can watch her. How about in the back? I got like a few more of these. All right. Now, you're only worried about, figuratively, you're only worried about what's in your envelope. Now, I know you're looking around and thinking, I wonder what's in the other envelopes. We don't care what's in the other envelopes. It's not as good as what's in your envelope. What's in your envelope is unique to you. Now, someone in a second is going to open the envelope. Don't open them yet. And the person who opens it is going to have a chance to look at it and try and decide what it is. The person surrounding that individual, acting as observers again, and what I'd like you to do is watch what they do. Watch what they do. Write down what they say. And we're only going to do this over like 2 minutes. So this is very short. So this is very easy. Pull it out, tell me what it is, and the observers are going to write down the conversations as well as what they did. All right, so we'll start the 2 minutes now. I still see someone studying it. It's really hard to let go of that. But I can tell you in an instant how I can get you to put it down by telling you what it is. But I wouldn't do that. How about a name for this? Anybody got a name for this? All right. I'll give you a name. You have a gullet. As a matter of fact, you might want to just take a look at your neighbors and see if they've got gullets too. Just try to check that out. So it looks like we have a lot of gullets. And, as it turns out, now you know as much as any 2-year-old. We've named it. You have a fact. It may not be a very satisfying fact, since gobs probably don't exist outside this room, but maybe you're not sure about this. But I could give you another name. Maybe this will make you feel better. Gymnococcus diatus. How many people does that make feel a bit better? Just three people. Well, there's another fact. That is what it is. Yes. Yes. Okay. We'll need the microphone.
I think that already implies that, I don't know, that it wouldn't be. It narrows down the range of things that it could possibly be.
Yes. How so?
Because we've seen naming schemes like that before.
Uh huh. And where have you seen a naming scheme like this before?
Usually with things that are living at some point, or
things are that's the greatest tentative answer I've ever heard. Things that are
it could be a rock, I don't know.
It could be a rock, yes. It's hard when you're not quite sure if it's the right answer, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we're working towards this right answer.
If it was a candy or something, you wouldn't say that.
Maybe
if
it's candy.
A bead, you probably wouldn't give it a name like that.
Well, what kinds of things did people do to figure out what this was? They smelled it. They touched it. I heard you saying that when I touch it, it turns color. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm going to check that one out, by the way, when I'm done. Yes. It's just the what?
What's that?
I'm sorry, I missed what you just said.
I just said I Googled the Latin you just put up there.
Oh, you did? What'd you find out?
I can't say.
Oh, you can't say? Okay, good. All right, don't say that. All right, but I want to find out, what else did people do to figure out what this was? He Googled it?
I shook it.
You shook it?
Shook it, yeah.
She shook it? Anybody plop it into their mouth? I see somebody laughing back there. They don't want to say they popped it in their mouth. Imagine that. You've done everything. You've done almost everything. I think you've done everything that an infant would have done in order to discover their own world. You touched it. You looked at it. You shook it. You banged it on the... a few of you plopped it into your mouth. And if an infant had more sophisticated tools like scissors, like this individual did, David did, he was busy trying to cut into this thing. You might have seen not 2-year-olds, maybe 4-year-olds busy trying to hatchet something to pieces. Well, this one here didn't do so well. What we've done here is that we're creating a skill. You're creating a skill. It's the first skill, this representation right up here, single representations. By naming this object, we have suspended, just for a second, all work at the single representation. For those of you who've gone a little bit further than that and started thinking about, maybe it has something to do with being alive, or, okay, now you can tell me what you found out.
Kentucky coffee tree.
That's a Kentucky coffee tree. So now if it's a tree, then it means something else about where this came from, and all of a sudden you're no longer at the single representational level anymore. We've gone beyond that. But I just wanted to highlight that first step because it's an important first step that we all take in education. When we name things, that giving something a name is an important process. It isn't something that we're just, often in education we're given it, but not often do we have the opportunity to build it for ourselves. So we sort of built a name for ourselves for this particular Gallup. What I'd like to do now is transition and talk about a problem that you did read about. And I'm going to use this problem now as a scaffold for the Farmer Jones problem. So I'm not going to solve the Farmer Jones problem for you, but I'm going to solve another problem for you. And we'll take a look at how one problem can help us think about the other problem. So I'm doing this also because that's the teacher in there. So I don't give you the answer. But I'm going to give you a similar answer, and we'll talk about that in a second. All right, so an example here of a single representational skill might be in this particular challenge, which is, oh, by the way, what is the challenge? Yes. Okay. Okay. Somebody else want to add to that? The goal is that all three of these wind up over here at the end, in that order. And that's the goal. And that, yes?
Are there other rules that you can only move a certain number at a time, like only move
one at a time,
or move one space at a time?
No, just one at a time. And that, in this case, you have two possibilities, right? You can move this to here, move that to there. And without any further thought about which one you might want to put it to, we have a single representation. It's sort of it would be to the extent that facing Farmer Jones' problem, you have three items you want to bring across the river. Which three? Doesn't matter. I'll bring one across. Okay, sera, sera. Well, doesn't matter. I'm not thinking beyond that step. You know, if I just by chance just took the grain across and the fox now had lunch, so. That single step without thinking about how its implications might, the implications of taking that step might impact what happens next. So, there's a single representation. The solution is limited to just a single move. I just picked one. There was another choice as well. That skill all by itself wouldn't be enough to solve the Tower of Hanoi problem, and that skill all by itself isn't enough to solve the Farmer Jones problem either. Immediately we run into problems if we arbitrarily bring any one of those three things across. You could be the right one by chance, but there's two chances out of three that you bring across the wrong thing. So we need a little bit more than that. We need to coordinate some thoughts, and it's somewhat similar to the thought of Gallup A. We could live with that word now, Gallup A. Because now you know that if I plant Gallup A, or Gallup, let's get rid of the word A for a second, I'm tripping myself up. If I planted a Gallup, then I would get a Kentucky coffee tree. I would not get a rose plant. I would not get cactus. I would not get a number of things. And you know that, and you shake your head and say, yeah, that all makes sense to me. But embedded in that idea is that, in this case, A could be a seed. Seed A gives you plant A. It doesn't give you anything else when you plant that. So, if you waited a couple of days, I know what you would get. Gallup A would return. Nothing would happen.
It says on the web that it's poisonous if it's not cooked.
Are you Googling this too?
When eaten raw, the seeds are poisonous.
I learned something. That would be another mapping. That would be like Gallup A, poisonous, if eaten as it is. Thank you, Kurt. So we can create lots of mappings out of this. But the mapping by itself may not be useful. Let's take a look with the Tower of Hanoi problem. So in this case, a mapping would require two moves. I'd have to do two things. So here is an example. I'll move moving the green ring to post C allows you to move the black ring to post B. Now that may be the step towards the solution, may not be, but it is a composite of two different steps where I can only do one move based on the move of another. So if I want to move the black, I have to move the green first. It's kind of arbitrary. In this case, I moved it to the C. Finish that thought. I move the green to C, I move the black to B. All right. So that solution all by itself is enough either. I mean, you can sort of see that with the Farmer Jones problem, where, well, I could bring the chicken across, and that would leave the fox with the grain. That's a safe move. That's a safe move. I come back, and then I can get one of the other two, and I'm still okay. But the problems begin when I'm on the other side of the river now. Now what do I do? So I need more than just one mapping. So the original mapping was I moved the green ring to post C, and I moved the black ring to post B. So all by yourself, we go, that's not enough. But here's an additional mapping. The green ring to post B and the red ring to post C. Let's take a look what that looks like. So now I get this. Now, each of these mappings could be somewhat arbitrary, but if you choose the original mapping as a step towards the new mapping, then you're doing something different. These two exist with each other for the purposes of solving the problem now, because there's only one last step or one last mapping that I'm not showing that'll get you to the solution. So we could have just two mappings all by themselves, but if they're not coordinated in a way that it leads to the solution, then they're independent of each other as separate mappings. But if they are coordinated with the purpose, your internal purpose of this allows me to do this, well, then we've done something different. We've created a system. So the little arrows to show us what we're going to do next is we're going to move the green as the last mapping. We'll move the green piece here so that we can move the black ring here, and then finally the green ring goes back. So one additional mapping. So it looks like to solve this problem, it can be done certain in three or four steps, but the hardest part is the middle, where you need to coordinate these two mappings that I'm showing right here to allow you to take the very last step, which is to move the green ring out of the way so you can move the black ring onto this post and finally the green ring. Building that system is a challenge, and you experience that with the Farmer Jones problem. Right? That I'm going to say that to solve this Farmer Jones problem, we don't need anything more complicated than a system. But creating that system, although you can do it, and you did it, is not something that you automatically do, and it's something that you need to build over time. Now, these are things that I know have come up in your conversations with each other and with the course instructors, is that the way I try to think about this is that this is a fairly fragile structure. It's certainly temporal, because someone said to me earlier that I remember I knew the answer, but I didn't know if I knew the answer now. Who shared that with me? Was that you? Yes, you came at this and you said, I had the answer once, I don't know if I have it now. In the sense that I still have to recreate it for myself. And that being able to recreate it depends on a number of different external things. I was trying to elicit some conversation about frustration, to the extent that frustration might keep you from actually completing the structure. Or not far from that might be actually your emotional state. If you started worrying that everybody else in the room got the answer, but I don't have the answer yet. I now see some people shaking their heads on that. Thank you. And that's certainly a dilemma that we face in classrooms. When someone goes, I got the answer, that shuts everybody else down. The contextual support, that was the role of the supporter in this. So to the extent that you were able to maybe just listen carefully to what the problem solver was trying to do and agree to some extent it might have been in tension with maybe pointing out to that person certain elements of the problem so that you were moving them closer to the solution. All of these factors are involved in every classroom all the time in a continual way. So you can see it's quite a challenge for an instructor, but it's also quite a challenge for you as well. Because I've already built it, now it's really about you building the same thing, or something similar to that. For those of you who didn't want to build a solution, what did you do? So I'll throw out that problem, I'll get a new problem. I'll get one with ropes and ladders, and I'm going to put that, and I can solve that kind of problem, because I have the tools to do that. And it's said that, to me, feels very natural that you would do that. You say, I have the skills to build this, I just haven't figured out how to put it together. But I don't want to fail at that problem, so I'll pick a problem that I can succeed at. And that, I think, is also the voice of many students going through an educational system, at least those who have not already been silenced. So let's take a look at this Tower of Hanoi problem as it unfolds in seconds, in this, or let's say minutes in our case. We have an individual move, one ring from one post to the other, without any planning about the consequences of that. So it indicates that I can do this, I can move the ring, so I do it. Something more sophisticated than that would require that I coordinate that move with some thought about the consequence of that move. In this case, if I move the green ring to C, that allows me to move the black ring to B. All by itself, that's not a solution. We looked at another mapping. I can move the green ring again and get this configuration. But by itself, that's not a solution until I coordinate the two and I see one in need of the other. That in order to do this, I need this. And probably, I think the important point of that combination is that it's a spatial-temporal skill. And the temporal part reminds us that we need to recreate the solution. Maybe not always. Maybe we can use a trick, as some of you described it. Keep the chicken with you, like you keep the problem child or the child who can't take care of themselves with you. In a way, what you've done is you've scaffolded yourself through that problem by keeping an essential part of the problem alive for you so that you can recreate the system representation. So by holding on to the key, in this case, keep the chicken with you, you facilitate your ability to recreate the system.
And which one's the chicken?
I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to leave that to you. Now, we didn't get a chance, you didn't get a chance to read this, so let's see what can we do with that. We can't do anything about your reaction to the article. Mostly favorable so far. How would you compare your experience? Ah, I can't do that. We might be able to do something. Now, you did, Clara was part of the reading, though, wasn't it? Okay. All right. So I guess I'll give you some context for that one, then. Why might the distinction between building and borrowing be important to educators? So I've been talking a little bit about that anticipation of talking about the reading, so... at this point, all you have to go on is what I've said so far about building versus borrowing. So let me just ask you about that. Given these two words that I've used, what are your thoughts about how these two words work together or work in opposition with each other? Or what is your reaction to those two ideas, collectively or separately? Someone needs a microphone.
So, in a way, are you saying that we're somehow building on things that we already know? So reflex would be natural, right, the first step. Once we have some control over that initial move, then we're borrowing from that one to build yet again, so on and so forth. Thus making a move, repeating it over and over again in different ways or different formats until we've somehow achieved something satisfying.
Okay, your thought... reminds me that I definitely want to clarify that there is a distinction for me between building and borrowing. So I'll get a few more ideas from you before I do that. Yes. Here it comes.
I thought building would be building yourself, building a model yourself, but according to me, it does work with borrowing because the problem solvers needed the support from the supporter, and that would be borrowing a bit. I don't know if that's right.
Okay. Yeah, they do sort of exist in tension. The first thing I'd like to do is sort of separate the two, that the building is really your operation. That's yours. Now, I've built a lot of as I said earlier, I built this sort of long story about how you could use a theoretical structure to make sense of the Farmer Jones problem and the Tower of Hanoi problem. To the extent that you were listening to that and able to make sense of that, you were borrowing. To the extent, now, I'll separate that from those of you who were now, go back to the Farmer Jones problem, could see the process in yourself where you could come up with a solution. Now you're doing the building. The borrowing part, I think we'll go back to the, I think Joy sort of reminded me of this. I think it was Joy that reminded me of this, is that the temptation of giving the answer. Now, I can give you the answer. And the answer is something that you can borrow or you can use, but it takes away or it does away with the step of you building it yourself. And my claim will be mostly that in education, what we do a lot of is we do, the transaction is more of borrowing, that you will borrow from me or you'll borrow from whoever's up front and you'll do less of the building. That it, if it's in tension with each other, it's the borrowing part that gets favored the most.
Would you say that things that students build for themselves, perhaps they maintain or are able to utilize better than things that they borrow?
Well, that's an interesting and provocative thought, and I think educators would love to believe that. That you built it, you've got it. But we already know, at least from one person, that building it doesn't mean that you've got it. Like you put it in the bank, and whenever you want it, you go back to the bank to get it. And again, I want to use Joy as sort of the key to that experience, that I solved this problem once, but I don't know if I could do it again until I actually go through it. So it's not, I banked it, sort of. Okay, someone else needs a microphone.
So maybe could it be that if there's the process of building, but if you continually add and build upon the problem, then you may be able to use it more as if than if you just built it once and then you try to come back to it years later. Would that possibly be a better process than just borrowing?
Well, what's your intuition say?
My intuition would say yes, it would be.
I'd go with your intuition.
How do you deal with the tension of the fact that we know a lot more as a society than would possibly that a child or a single person would be capable of building.
That's sort of the great anxiety of education.
Certain things that, I mean, you wouldn't expect someone to like reinvent calculus. You would have to give it to them, right?
Yes. So those, some very important points there. One is that society has much more knowledge than we might think that any one student could build on their own. So that forces us to reconsider how much can we ask any student to take on. And another point is we wouldn't expect students to reinvent calculus since it took one person, or maybe two, depending on when this process started, but those of you who know the history of Newton and Leibniz will know that it took them, and they were the only two that we can tell from their period that came up with calculus, that we wouldn't give that as a challenge to our students in class. But their understanding of calculus would have to be something they built on their own.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you're borrowing, if you can rebuild the understanding and the representation that the person is giving to you, then, I mean, it's not like building the solution from scratch, but you are building something.
Yes, and that was, to some extent, that's what the supporter was there for. That a supporter, in a sense, doesn't give the answer, because giving the answer sort of short-circuits the approach of you building the answer, but you can't rebuild calculus on your own. And in an educational process, we're not trying, I wouldn't advocate for a system where we know it failed, actually, so I don't have to tell you anything that probably would shock you, that we've already tried, there was a whole, in science, higher education, we spent a number of years trying to have students rediscover properties of science, and that never worked. Yes?
But I don't think that you can talk about building without talking about learning style. Like, I was just thinking about that, like what Piaget had said about interacting with the environment and how that's important. And I guess that not all learners need the same environment. And I was just thinking about how this was like the last thing that they gave me, like just in the final, like, minute or two was something kinesthetic, but it was what reached me the most. And I think it's really interesting because you might also be under the impression that you're enabling your learners to build, but if you're not giving them the tools that reach them, then they're really, it just looks like they're building. And
yes,
it's so interesting because for children, that's often, you know, children are often given lots of different tools, but in adult education, it's often just, you know, they're not. Like, this was the last thing, but I bet if I were a child, it might be the first thing I would have been given. And, yeah.
And it's hard to know, either, unless you really listen to the problem solver. And that was part of the impetus of having a problem solver who wasn't going to give an answer, to realize that that's not an easy task to have. That you have to wait long enough to find out what is it that's going to help that person make sense of the problem and work with that. That's where they start. Okay, so I'll take maybe one more question. So I have a... I haven't heard from you.
Attention in terms of how much you have to rebuild something, and depending on the foundations of that structure that you've built, how far you can go in terms of building something new, I guess, in terms of the calculus. How well do you have to understand calculus or how it was developed in order to be able to go beyond that? Because as a society, I think we want to continuously expand our boundaries and go beyond, but there's a time issue there of how deeply you have to delve into something to be able to create something new, and how good is that new thing going to be dependent upon how deep the structures were that support the new thing.
Your thought, your comment was leading me to lots of thoughts. And I'm not sure, it's probably just a parallel thought. It was the idea that building an understanding of calculus, as those of you who've attempted to do it already in your own schooling, realize that takes time. And those of you who didn't do anything with it, looking back on that experience, you may be wondering, what did I actually learn? What do I do with that? I mean, you may be able just to name calculus at this point. You can say, the things with the squiggles, that's calculus. So you're back to the single representation. So that may be one path that you may have taken it further than that, but at this point in your lives, you may be looking at, I don't have the path up. I'm almost out of power. Let's see if I can make it go away. Oh, there it is. Let me summarize in 2 minutes. That's how much power I have. And I have all the bullets for you, but let's see if I can do this without making it sound like I'm just reading through this. Let's see, microdevelopment, and here we talk about skill development in the short term, assumes that learning is a dynamic activity between you and the environment. And so today we've played a lot with the idea that your supporters made a difference and your own feelings could make a difference. We didn't talk so much about the biology part, that as adults, being able to build systems of representations is not a large task for you. But we didn't give this problem, and you wouldn't expect me to give this problem, to a 4-year-old. Why not? I think the answer is obvious. That for them to build this kind of a system would be a monumental challenge because their biology isn't ready yet for that. Or it's just on the cutting edge. Microdevelopment is an attempt to follow in detail any evolution understanding. The observed skills in microdevelopment pathways have the same properties observed in longer timescales. So I borrowed Piaget's work, rebuilt it for myself, and then on top of that layered Kurt's work, layered that into it. Now I have a model that helps me make sense of changes in understanding over time. So I have two slides here, educational implications. Building versus borrowing is every educator's challenge. I've said this several times during my presentation. The Tower of Hanoi helped me scaffold your understanding about microdevelopment. And we're going to try and distinguish between scaffolding and support. I mean, scaffolding is something that I'm doing with you, so it's a variation of maybe what you've read in the literature. That puts you in the role of borrowing. I was in the role of building. And now you have the opportunity to be in the role of building. Is that me? We'll have to wait. The Tower of Hanoi scenario, independently of me, can act as support. So this is something that you can take with you and to the extent that you want to take this on as a challenge, you can build all the steps from your own notes about what happened as you move towards that solution. Like, what would be the single representation, what would be the mapping, and what would be the system. And here's my last slide. And then you can, and then Yara will make this available to all of you later. That any understanding of microdevelopment that you achieve will be based on what you build. So I hope that this was at least a pleasant couple hours. But it could be something that just goes away as you go on to your next activity. So what I take away is the idea that I, with you, was able to build something new, but the challenge is still open to you and to your students as well. And the educator's challenge is to identify the tools, the mental and physical, and provide the experiences that will facilitate that process. So I'd like to go back to, I don't see your name, but just behind you in the green sweater. Yes, you. Your name? Ping was reminding me of this bullet as I was listening to her, that there's a lot involved in asking a child to build any knowledge. And to the extent that you can fool yourself, as Nancy might suggest that we could fool ourselves, in thinking that the child actually built something that's their own. If we give them tools that are unfamiliar to them, both physical tools, like instead of giving them paper, we gave them something else, and also mental tools, the kinds of ideas, like keep the chicken with you. It's like the problem child. I don't want to say the problem child, I don't like that, but the child that needs lots of supervision. So it could be a mental tool, and some of you may say, I don't understand, I don't get it. How does keeping the child with me help me solve this problem? That may be something that some of you had thought of as you heard that as a possible way of getting you to the solution. So this mix is something that we only get at through very careful listening, which is something that the name tag's already gone, but... I'm looking at you now. Joy, is your name Joy? No, not you. There's Joy. That is the name that goes with the face. Sorry. For some reason, I was thinking something we talked about. But in any case, it's something that came up in many conversations. Is you only really understand what you need to do as a teacher once you understand where the student is beginning, and you only really do that by listening, right? And that may take a long time. So I'll conclude with that thought. Thank you.